Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name's Arthur, and I'm an alcoholic. I drank because I like drinking. I didn't go about in tea bars, as I'm seeing here now, and I didn't drink half pints. I don't think this made me an alcoholic, but I suppose the way I drank, it certainly didn't help. I travelled about many parts of the world drinking all the time. I couldn't tell you much about the places, but I knew where the bars were. And eventually came back home, where I lived, next to a public house, right next to my door, so I didn't have to go very far for a drink. Well, there was always my wife running in, or somebody was running in to call me out of there, so eventually I moved further afield, and they could never find me, and I was drinking all over the place. But as time went on, I've always liked all types of jazz music, and I used to take all kinds of jazz bands in my house, and this would be any day of the week, Mondays, Wednesdays. It wasn't on a Saturday night, it was any night, and I had three children upstairs trying to get some sleep, and my wife, and all this noise would start, and there was more noise going in my house than what there was in the pub. So eventually there was rows and arguments and people sleeping on couches and armchairs and all kinds of people. I don't know who they were really. They used to call themselves Bill, John, Brummy, Jock, all kinds of names. I didn't know where they lived or where they came from. All I knew that they could take a good drink, and they suited me. So eventually my wife came down one night, or early in the morning, early hours in the morning. And she's a very small woman, she's not 5 foot high, and I always used to take these great big men home, and she said, "Get out, a lot of you." And I said, "How dare you?" I said, "These are my friends." She said, "You don't find friends in pubs." I said, "Mine are. All my friends are in pubs." And I really believed that. And of course she immediately lost control of herself, which was rather unusual, and she hit me across the head with a frying pan, and my head started bleeding, and I said, "You've cut my head, that's the finish, I can't tolerate you any longer." And I walked out of the house, just what I stood up in, and plenty of money in my pocket, fortunately. I was able to get hold of quite a bit of money because I used to work in markets, and I used to get hold of quite a bit, you know. I was the type of chap that used to go into pubs with plenty of money, throw it down on the counter, everybody have a drink, and if they didn't get drunk, well, I was rather surprised. And people used to come to my house when I wasn't there, because I was never there. And she'd say, the wife would say, "I can't tolerate this any longer. You're... husband is getting my husband drunk. He's now lost 4 days' work." And I said, "I don't know what they're talking about." Mind you, the woman wasn't speaking to me. My wife always took the brunt of it. I said, "They can't take it." I said, "The trouble is," I said, "they don't know how to drink." I said, "They're falling and rolling about all over the place." I said, "And it's just too bad." So it never really bothered me. I wasn't worried about anybody falling on the floor, because I never fell on the floor. I don't know if any of you did, but I used to drink like, as that chap was saying, like out of a bucket, you know. In the beginning, I was drinking out of very fine glasses, you know. It was all very, very nice, all these polished glasses and that, but it came to the stage when I was drinking out of a jam jar. But eventually, as I say, I did walk out, and I left my wife with three children, three sons. One of them was a schoolboy, and the other two were going, two of them were going to school. The other one was only about 2 years of age. And I thought this was the answer to it. So I floated about all over the country, drinking all the time, and the money eventually, I was doing no work at all, and the money eventually started to go down very fast, and the way I drank, there was it had to. So I never thought, and I'd never ever been into any lodging house or kip house or whatever you like to call it. We call them kip houses, and I did hear a man say, "What on earth's that? What on earth are you talking about? Kip houses?" You know, some of them talk like that. And I finished up in these kinds of places, but of course I was drinking so fast, nobody couldn't keep up to me. My brother-in-law said, "I've never seen anybody drink as fast as you." I said, "I'm always thirsty," which I was. Eventually, I was finishing up in cider stores and places like this, and it was very cheap in there, and the chap said, "What are you going to drink?" And I said, "I'll have, what do they drink then?" So he said, "Well, it's, you can have perry," that sounded rather posh to me, he said, "you can have sweet or mixed, or you can have rough." He said, "I shouldn't drink the rough," he said, "farmers drink that." I said, "I am a farmer." He said, "You're not a bloody farmer." He said, "You're a Londoner." He said, "You're a Cockney." So I said, "I'm a farmer now." So I drank a couple of these pints of Scrumpy, and didn't taste too bad, very cheap. I thought, "This is handy." I didn't have much money, and they was all gobbling it down, and, you know, they was putting all their money on the tables and drinking big jugs of this stuff. I thought, "It must do you good." Some of them was having a fight on the floor. I thought, I don't know, another fellow was playing the piano. It's all part of it, you know what I mean. Alcoholic. Well, I was. I don't know what they were. Nutcases, by the look of it. One chap actually got a saw out of his pocket. They carry on weird things. He had this little saw, and he got it out, and he said to a chap, "Would you like to buy this for a shilling?" They spoke posh as well. God knows where they'd come from. He said, "Let me try the temper." The temper. They only had about tuppence in their pocket. He went, bang, broke it in half. There was a fight again on the floor. So I was looking round in this place, you know, and I thought I was superior to some of these people, you know. There was one cooking a kipper over a fire. There was an open fire in there. And there was another one, he was boiling an egg in a little saucepan, and another one was pulling the middle out of a loaf, and he was stuffing that down him. And I thought, what a bloody place. Fancy coming in here. I mean, I'm not like these people. And I certainly didn't think I was. And he said, "How are you getting on with that rough?" So I said, "It's not too bad." I said, "But it's making my legs a bit wobbly." I said, "I'll get over it." So he said, I said, "I don't think I'll come back here anymore." I said, "It's like a bloody madhouse." So he said, "You'll be back." So I said, "I won't." He said, "They all say that, mate." He said, "You'll be back." Because I did go back. I went back many, many times. And I finished up round near Waterloo Station, what they used to call the hole in the wall. And that was, that talk about a madhouse, that was exactly what it was. And this went on and on until I had no money at all. It doesn't last, you know. And the money started to dwindle all the way, and I never had no money to get in the kip house. It was bloody awful. And I was crawling about in parks, and one night I was half stewed up, and I was walking through the park, and I came across this graveyard, which I used to always have a kip in. And as I was walking through the graveyard, it was pouring with rain, and there was an open grave there, and I slipped and I fell right in it. And as I tried to scramble out, like the early hours of the morning, there was two women going to clean some offices or something outside the wall, and my head came up above the grave. And I was screaming and I was shouting and I was saying, "Help me, for God's sake." And two women looked over and they said, "My God, look at that." I said, "Give us a hand out, darling, will you?" And they went running down the road like a couple of lunatics, completely mad. As you can see, I eventually did get out. I was taken into a mental hospital. Yes. And completely mad I was, raving mad. They put me in a straitjacket that couldn't hold me down. Stuck me in a cell. My wife came in. She said, I've never seen anything so ghastly in my life. I didn't know what she was talking about. I don't even remember being in the straitjacket. I got out of it anyway. And folded it up nice and neat and put it in the corner of the cell. The chap said, how did you do that? I said, I used to work in a circus at one time. He said, a bloody circus. He said, you are a circus. Well, eventually I got pulled out of this cell, and a chap, my sponsor's a Scotsman, and, or he was, he's not alive today, and he came into this hospital a long, long time ago now, and I thought it was when he was standing there, and I thought that fella was after me just now. I thought he was a copper, and he said, your name, Arthur? I said, yes. He said, have you got a drinking problem? I said, have I got a drinking problem? I said, I've got thousands of problems. I said, sit down, mate. I'll tell you all about them. He said, I don't want to hear your problems. He said, you listen to mine. I said, I don't want to listen to your problems. I said, I don't know you. I said, where do you come from? He said, I come from Glasgow. I said, if they sent you all the way down from Glasgow, I said. He said, no. He said, I live here. He said, I live in not far away from this hospital. He said, I come in here to see people like you. I thought, blimey. I said, have you got a fag? So he put his hand in his pocket, and he got out a packet of Woodbines, and he said, take one of them. I said, you're smoking pliers. He said, I know, mate. He said, I carry a few packets around with me, he said, and I give them to people like you in the hospital. I said, well, have you got a match? So he said, yes. So I said, well, I'm not allowed matches. So he said, well, have a light. He said, and give me the matches back. He said, would you like to come to a meeting? I said, meeting? What is it? He said, it's a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, never heard of them. So he said, I said, what do they do there then? He said, they talk. I said, what about? He said, drink. I said, I don't want to talk about bloody drink. I said, I'm in here for drink. I said, that's why I was locked up in that cell. Oh, he said, this is slightly different, he said. They talk about other things as well. I said, but you can't get me out. I said, I'm in a locked ward. So he said, I'll go and see the doctor. I thought, these AA people, they got some kind of a power. So he went in and he saw the doctor, and he came out with a small pass. He said, I've got your pass. He said, I'm fully responsible for you. He said, and I'm going to take you to a meeting and bring you back to this hospital tonight. Get your overcoat on. I said, I haven't got one. So he said, it's freezing outside. I said, I know it is. He said, what have you done with it? I said, flogged it. So he said, you flog everything, don't you? I said, when I want a drink, I do, yeah. So he said, well, come as you are. So he took me out, and I stood outside the hospital near the bus stop, and it was freezing, and no bus came along, and I said, I can't stand this, I better go back in the hospital. So he said, just a minute, and he called a taxi. I thought, lovely, taxis, this is what it's all about, you see. He told me he was a plumber. I thought myself, plumber? Didn't look like a plumber to me. He was well-dressed. I thought, well, the situation is that their governors are firms. I'll have to behave myself. It's no good losing your temper, because they give me money, clothes, and jobs, and all this kind of thing. And mind you, he's not bought anything at the moment. He seems a bit bloody tight to me. So he said, jump in the taxi. So I jumped in the taxi. I said, any more fags? So he said, yes, I've got another packet of Woodbines. And this Woodbine light really got up my nose. I thought, bloody Woodbines, I don't know. So we got in the meeting, and it was full. There was not many meetings about in those days. And he said, you sit down the front. I can't see any seats in the front, but there's nearly always one. Yes, there's one over there. He said, you sit down in the front, he said. He said, and I stand at the back. I thought, you would. That's to stop me getting out. I couldn't see no alcoholics. They was all sitting there, all dressed up. There wasn't many women about in AA in them days. And he said, there was a chap sitting in the chair with a beautiful suit on. He had an overcoat. I was looking at the clothes. But a velvet collar, these velvet collars, and a bowler hat. He had an umbrella, briefcase. I thought, they can't be alcoholics. An alcoholic to me was a man, I didn't know about the women, that finished up in the gutter drinking methylated spirits with no money, no home, and disowned by everybody. Well, that was the state I was in. And I thought, well, I am the world's worst alcoholic. And I shall get hold of a newspaper or something and give them my story, which I'll get a few bob off, I expect. Nobody gave me anything there. One chap, he was sitting there, and he said, would you like a cigarette, John? So John said, yes, I would. So he said, well, have one of these, he said. They're passing cloud. And he got out a large 100 box of cigarettes. I never had a bloody wood behind me by this stage. I thought, 100 box of passing cloud? And the fellow that he gave it to was something like him, too. They all spoke with a university accent, if you know what I mean. And he said, absolutely lovely. He said, I thoroughly enjoyed this. He said, they're lovely and flat. He said, they fit my lips perfectly. I said, I know what'll fit your lips in a minute, mate. So I came away from that meeting. I was taken back to the nut house again, and they kept coming along. They wouldn't let me out, you see. I was in there for 3 months. I didn't know, but when I went to see my sponsor, I said, I'm discharged. He said, you've been in for 6 months, not 3 months. He said, they wouldn't let you out. He said, mate, you was going too mad. I wish I did do. But eventually I came out, and I went to his house. I knew where he lived. So I thought, right, I'll have a go at him, right? My wife wouldn't have me back home by this stage. My brother-in-law said, flogging a dead horse. He's useless, hopeless. Lock him up for life. We don't want nothing to do with him. Keep him away from us. He goes completely mad. So they never came. My wife came, and eventually, as time went on, I did go back to my sponsor, Jim, and I said, they won't let me in my home. So he said, who done the drinking? I said, I did. So he said, have you got any money? So he said, no. So I said, can you give me a suit? So he said, I haven't got any. So I said, can you get me a job? And he'd have just by this stage had had enough of me because I'd, he'd been coming to the meeting, to the hospital for quite a long time now. And he said, this is not a labour exchange. I said, I didn't say it was. I said, I hate the bloody sight of you. So he said, do you really? I said, how am I going to get to these meetings? About 90 meetings in 90 days. I said, I couldn't do 9 in 9 days, about 90. So he said, there's a where to find. I said, I can't bloody well eat that, mate. I'm starving. He said, look down that meeting book, he said, and you'll find, he said, that there are meetings here and there. I said, they're miles away. I said, there's one here, another one 5 miles away, another one 6 miles away. I said, how am I going to get to them? I said, I haven't got any money to get on a bus. So he said, walk. I said, walk? He said, yes, mate. He said, if that book was full of pubs, and you was drinking, and somebody told you that there was a pub down the road 20 miles away, and they was giving free booze away, he said, you'd walk there when you was drinking, wouldn't you? I said, yes. He said, well, walk here. So I continued to walk. That was the first lesson that I got in AA, and I started to walk around, hating the sight of everybody, and I went into a meeting at Chelsea in London, one night on a Tuesday, and still hadn't got back to me home, and quite a number of months had gone by. I'm still right round the bend, and a man sat in the chair there, very well dressed, and he said, my name's John, and I'm an alcoholic. I hated the bloody sight of him, and he put a monocle in his eye, and he sat there, and I thought, I've never seen an alcoholic with a monocle. And he told a story, you know, and I thought, I don't like him, and I don't like any of the others in here. And I went down the market that next day, and lo and behold, there was a monocle lying on the stall. So I picked it up, and I thought, you have to get a waistcoat. So I got a waistcoat off of a rag stall, stuck it on, and a piece of string, and I put it in my pocket. And I went down the meeting early, and this chap wasn't in the chair. And I said, where is he? He said, well, he doesn't always take the chair. So I said, oh, don't he? I said, he knows I'm coming, that's why. He said, no, 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 Arthur. He said, he doesn't know you're coming at all. He said, just sit down and listen. Well, I couldn't bloody listen to anybody, me. So the chairman opened the meeting in the usual way, And he hadn't spoke for about 2 minutes, and I got the monocle out, and I put it in my eye. And he went, I thought, that stopped you, mate, didn't it? And the man sitting aside of me, as you know, you all look forward, and the man sitting aside of me said, what the bloody hell are you doing, he said. He said, what do you think this is, a music hall? He said, take that out of your eye. I said, won't. I said, he had one in last night, and I've got one in tonight. He said, he always wears one. I said, so do I now. And I wouldn't take it out. And he told people in the meetings a long, long time later, this fella put a monocle in his eye, and the fella was looking at me as I was right round the bend. I'm still a bit round the bend, but not quite so bad as when I was drinking. Eventually, I was going around many, many meetings, day after day and night after night, and still hadn't got back to my home. The time was going by, and I could hear people saying, absolutely ghastly, I can't tolerate it at all. I was drinking large bottles of brandy in my lounge, and I thought, in your lounge, mate. I was crawling about in the kip house, in the park, down in the graveyard, and he's talking about bottles of brandy in the lounge. And I started to dislike these people very, very much indeed. And it said, one man, he read out, he said, eat plenty of food. And I thought, plenty of bloody food. I haven't even got a cheese roll about plenty of food. So he said, what you want to do, he said, is to make sure, he said, that you look at this just for today card, he said. It says, speak with a low and courteous voice. And I was screaming the place down. And he said, it says in there too, dress becomingly. Dress becomingly. I was walking about like a tramp. I thought, well, where do you get the clothes? Who's going to give me a suit? They're as tight as they come. They don't give you nothing. Nobody's giving me any suit. Nobody's giving me any money. They're making these collections at the meetings there. They won't tip the box out and give it to me. Nobody's been to my wife and asked her, please let him come back home. He's now a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he has been now for 6 months. And no, he still wouldn't want me back. And there was a meeting in Charing Cross Road one Saturday night, and I went up there, and it was over the top of a pub, so you had a choice. You could either have a drink or go up to the meeting. So I used to go up to the meeting, struggle up. And when I went up there, there was all these posh people there, you know, all sitting there, men and women, and I had an old Mac on and an old pair of trousers and jacket and a dirty old shirt. Well, not actually dirty, but ragged. And I looked at the chap in the chair and he said, my name's Tommy and I'm an alcoholic. And he said about four words and I got up. I was sitting down in the audience and I said, just a minute. I said, I want a few words here. He said, yes, Arthur, what did you want to say? I said, I'll tell you what I wanted to say, mate. Get out of there. I want to give you a real good lesson on this. And a chap told me this afterwards. And I'd been sober 6 months. He said, you went up to the table. He said, Tommy still sat there. He said, and you banged it with your fist. And you said, listen to what I've got to say, you lot. My name's Arthur, and I'm an alcoholic. And I made an ironing board in Maudsley Hospital. I went into every detail of this ironing board. And it went on for 45 minutes. And the man was looking at his watch like a lot of people do. And a woman was sitting there, and she was going round the bend. I think she was waiting to say I would like to come in, you know, but I wouldn't let anyone come in. And she said, what's the matter with that man? She said, he hasn't spoken anything about hospitals or drink or what it's done to his family. She said, is he drunk? He said, no, he's not drunk. She said, well, if he's not drunk, she said, he must be mad. She said, get him into hospital. He said, he's just come out. Well, the name stuck to me, and eventually it went all over the place, and I was nicknamed, and I still am, Ironing Board Arthur. Eventually, I did start to take an active part in AA, and many, many years ago, Jim, my sponsor, and Albert, who was half blind, and myself started a meeting after I'd been in for about 12 months at the Oval, near the Oval Cricket Ground in London, and that was about 29 years ago. I don't say this to be big-headed. always does get me a little bit worried when I say that kind of thing. I don't know why. This is the type of person I am. I'm so very, very grateful for what has happened to me during my sobriety. I've got the respect of my three sons back. I've got the respect of my wife back. And I've got my own self-respect back. I have my sister here from Canada, and she's just come over. We lost most of our family in an air raid, and she escaped. And they put this tragedy down that was the reason that I was an alcoholic. In those days, they didn't know much about alcoholism, I can assure you. And it wasn't accepted as an illness. But after I'd been in for a few years, it was accepted as an illness, and I felt very, very pleased about it. But we did start taking an active part, and I had no money at all. And I eventually got back to my home, and I started to go round with old Albert to do 12-step work. And I said, I haven't got any money. And he said, don't bother about money. Just talk to them. And we started to go to numerous hospitals. I was still keeping sober. And then a man said to me, would you like to come along to a prison? I said, prison? I don't want to go no prison. So he said, well, we do talk in there. He said, and we're looking for speakers. So I said, all right, I'll come along. And eventually went to many, many prisons all over different parts of England and over to the Isle of Wight, and became very interested in it, where another man and myself was running a group in there for quite a long time on a Sunday afternoon. I had great respect when I went into this prison one Sunday, and we had held a party for prisoners' children in Lambeth, and we had some top-class artists from the London Palladium, and they say, alcoholics can't do it, sober ones can. And it all started there, and I had quite a kick when I went down to that prison with George, and we went in there, and they held the meeting, and I wondered what was going on in the big main hall. And we stood there like this, just the two of us, and all the prisoners stood up. And there was a piece of toilet paper, came right the way round under their legs, and it came round onto the table, which was down on the floor, and I got hold of it, and I thought, what's that? And it said, we would like to thank you, the prisoners of this prison, for what you two men have done for our children. We certainly do appreciate it. I should have framed that, I think, but many, many things like that have happened. And when they talk about a higher power, I had the privilege of going to Ireland on one occasion, and I'm always hearing about doing 12-step jobs, like all you are. And I was asked to go and see a man, and we travelled from one side of Ireland to the other, to Northern Ireland. And eventually we got him into hospital. But the plane that I was supposed to be on went down in the sea, only because I was in this hospital and I missed it. So I do believe that there is something that does look after us. I'm quite convinced of that. But many, many strange things have happened to me during the time that I've been in AA. And I found that after a reasonable length of time in the fellowship, I made friends with a man, and he was from an entirely different walk of life to me, and he had plenty of money, and he used to take me around in his big car, and I loved it. And he said, I said, you've got to do this 12-step work. And his wife hardly saw him, because I had him out till 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And I thought, you get it the rough way now, mate. I'm going to give it to you. And I'm taking him round to kip houses, spikes, and all the places I could find. And he'd never, and when I said, we're going to the spike, he didn't know what a workhouse was. And he said, what is this place, Arthur? And I said, it's a spike. And he said, it's absolutely ghastly. And he said, I can't stand it. I said, well, you'll stand this. And we went to many, many hospitals. And one day he said, we've got a new one. It's like a dog catching race. And we went down to this hospital, and he said, the doctor has told me, he said, that you can, we can take this patient to the hospital. So we went up and got him and took him in the car and took him to a meeting at Streatham. And during that time, the meeting finished and we had a cup of tea and we took him back. He said, you take him up. He said, and I'll wait down here for you. So I took him up, and the male nurse had changed staff just as we were coming out. He unlocked the door, let me in, and there was a new male nurse on. And the fella went through the back into a door into another ward. And the male nurse came out and said, would you like a cup of tea? And I said, no, thank you, I just had one. He said, have another one. I said, I don't want one. He said, have a biscuit. I said, I don't want a biscuit. He said, well, sit down and you'll be all right in a moment. So I said, I'm all right now. And I thought, keep calm. You know, they tell you to keep calm in AA. I thought, if I start getting excited, they'll put me back in one of them cells again. So he said, just sit down there, he said, and have a cup of tea, he said, and he said, we all feel a little bit depressed at times. So I said, I'm not depressed, mate. I said, and I will give you a warning now. Always carry that where to find with you, because you never know where you might be. And I got it out like a magic wand, and I said, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, I'm terribly sorry. He said, I thought you was a patient. He said, and he opened the door and let me out. Well, many, many humorous things have happened to me, but quite a number of serious things, as they do to many people. This is considered by the World Health Organization in Geneva as the third or fourth worst illness in the world, and there is no cure. I don't know anywhere else where I could come into a hall like this and see all these people that are sitting here sober. This program works. It works for anybody that wants it to work. Some of us have to want more than others. And some of us have to be prepared to put up with a certain amount of suffering along the road of sobriety. I put up with a certain amount of suffering like many of you. And if there is any newcomer here this morning, stick it out. Because it is going to work day by day. You don't see yourself changing. And gradually and slowly, as I was standing at my door, waiting for my wife to come out, she came to the door, and a member was coming to pick me up in a car. A husband and wife that lived across the road for many years came up to my wife and said, oh, hello, she said, you do look lovely. She said, how is your husband? Has he passed away? So I said, no, I haven't passed away. I said, I'm standing here. I dashed into the house and I went into the kitchen and I said to my wife, what she bloody will mean passed away? She said, you should have passed away, the state you was in. She said, but she didn't recognise you. I didn't realise then that they hadn't actually recognised me after a number of years of sobriety. And I know that people do change. Families change. This is a family illness. This don't only affect me. My wife was treated just as bad as I was, and she's not an alcoholic. My children were pointed at school because of the things that I was doing. The boot goes on the other foot. It takes time. All her family were pointing at me. I've had the privilege now of going to Canada, traveling many parts of the world. Since I've been in AA, and I never thought it would ever be possible, I couldn't even go down to the road to a common at one time, because I never had the money. I'm not saying for one moment that because you become sober, that you suddenly come into a fortune. Certainly not. But there is one thing that money will not buy, and that is sanity. And it will not buy friendship. And it will not buy people like you that are sitting there, because it was people like you that showed me that this worked. And this was just one Scotsman, not thousands of them, just one. And he would not give up. I owe everything that I've got at this moment to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not ashamed to say I've got nothing to be ashamed of now. I can walk out there amongst all the others. Providing I don't pick up that first drink, I can lead a reasonable and normal life. I love you all, and I love AA, because it was through this kind of thing that made me sit down and think, it does work, but some of us have to want more than others. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.